Adventures of a Serial Entrepreneur. Real entrepreneurs, real businesses, real stories. Episode 2, Part 2. You know, during that period, I was learning all these leadership skills at work and developing my own style and strategies and so forth from university and in my own business. And so I created something which gave us immediately a unique value proposition and a point of difference from all of our competitors, which was the first school of its kind, which still goes today, called the Australian DJ School, which was DJ and MCs. And that was the single thing that allowed us to scale. By having, you know, those systems, having a certification course, which we created, and we wrote a code of ethics. So, you know, going back to the episode one, where we had all those connections with those agents and so forth, we dominated the five-star hotels, we were able to create a certain standard that our competitors couldn't compete with.
And that's because of the school?
Because of the school and because of the way we ran the business. And, you know, look, I'll jump forward a little bit in terms of cash flow, but simple principles we implemented, such as that if you wanted to work with us, you only got paid when we got paid. Now, I know we'll talk about that later, about how that works in terms of the difference that can make in terms of cash flow and how to finance and help you scale your business. But here I was, I had this thriving business, and every time I went to university, it was carving me to pieces. Why am I going to university? What's it costing me to sit there in this lecture? And it was doing my head in that I'd be probably spending $500 to sit there for a three-hour lecture when I should have been working on my business. Come 1986, I could see that Cockatoo Dockyard was going to get into a lot of trouble. The Oberon-class submarines were coming to the end of their life. They were refitted every 4 years. That kept a nice big revenue income stream for that business. The HMAS Success had been launched. It was going to sea trials, so that was pretty much gone. And they were tendering on the Collins-class submarines, which were $3 billion, that's B, billion-dollar submarines to be manufactured. And I went to my manager at the time. I was so confused, you know, am I prepared to throw down the towel on engineering? I'm now nearly towards the end of my my studies. Am I prepared to let that go? Or am I going to be the big entrepreneur and you know, focus on my business? And so I went to my boss and I said, because what was happening in the very beginning when I was on the tools where they were doing this, it was happening in the office. The work was drying up. And they were not developing me and or allowing me to develop myself in any way, shape, or form in terms of management and leadership. And so I went down and I've now got all these new skill sets. I've been there for 4 years. And I said, look, you guys know I run these businesses. Oh, yes, Rick, we know you run businesses. The phones run pretty hot here all the time, people wanting to speak to you. In fact, you get more phone calls than we get phone calls. And that's a true story.
Did it really interfere with your work, though?
No, because I was the only person, again, back to the way I worked from the beginning. Every day they would give me work and I'd knock it off, finish it off. I'd go down to my boss and I'd say, I finished that job. What's next? Look, you just keep yourself busy and when I come up with something, I'll come up and give it to you. So I was the one always chasing work. And that, of course...
So you had the authority as such to keep yourself busy.
I did,
and between the jobs that
I did, and I was either working on my thesis, which was to do with wear resistant coatings for machining applications. Would you believe, of all things, as irrelevant as that might be to what we're talking about, but I was working on that, which was a big deal because that took 1 year, or I was working on my business, and the thing that got the look in the least was the work that they were giving me, and basically, it was stifling me from moving forward. And so ultimately, push came to shove. I went down, I said, look, I want to bring something to this business, but it has to be conditional. You need to elevate me to some kind of management status. You need to give me work that's going to be highly responsible and it's going to make me work and keep me busy. And I want to make a difference to this place and help it survive because I could, and I said to them, I don't think this place is going to last any more than a year or two from this point forward. I don't think we're going to win the Collins-class submarines tender. And sure enough, they didn't get the Collins-class submarines. And within a year, pretty much the place you know, fired most of the people that worked there. They were left with a few hundred people out of 2,300. And I resigned. At that point, I already had two full-time staff. I was meeting my staff members after work every day, basically between 4:30 and 5:30, and I would brief them for an hour before they went home, and the next day they would come into work and they'd do their work, and they were running the business. The business was already running on autopilot at this point in time.
So you're in the island in the morning doing your job.
Early,
doing your, you know, hour and a half debrief, brief, or
whatever. Hour max.
Then going to university.
And then after university,
working on your business.
Studying.
Like you couldn't possibly have gotten much sleep during that time.
That's the 2 to 7, or seven to two.
7 to 2.
How did you
manage to do that for 4 years?
That's grit. And we'll talk about grit in another episode. And there's 5 ways in which you can develop grit. Now, I was developing grit from a very early age, from motocross, from sport, from working with my dad, watching him, and it was ingrained in me. So I did have the upper hand. Mm. Most people that go into business don't realize that grit is an essential ingredient and probably one of the most subjects which we don't talk about, which leads to people's undoing, because they don't realize how much stamina and persistence is needed in order to quite often get these things up and running. Yes. Because, you know, people, they go out there and they look for the $500,000, you know, VC to come in and throw money at it. We had money from nowhere. All of this was done through bootstrapping. Mm. We, you know, every cent that I made was plowed back into the business. At one point, the business grew so much, it was taking over the entire enormous house that I had. And I ended up sleeping on a corner on the floor because the whole house was full of all the assets.
So you're running it from home, basically.
At that point, I was running it from home.
And how fast did it grow? What sort of numbers are we talking?
Well, it was basically 20, 40, 80, 160, 320. It was in excess of doubling every year. Right. So at the point when I pivoted, when I resigned, went in, bit the bullet, and then my father came and worked with me full-time as well. He had a full-time job. He bit the bullet. He let his full-time wage go as well, as did I. He came and worked with me. That was a significant pivot. Now, I dragged the university studies out. I was like 3/4 of the way through, and then I took my time to finish it off. And I thought, well, look, I've come this far. I may as well finish, because if I don't, one thing that went through my head is, well, maybe I'll need to fall back on this thing one day. Well, that has never happened. And number two, really what I said was, well, if I don't finish it now, I may never forgive myself for not finishing. Mm. Now, when you contrast that with what happens today, I mean, 3 out of every 10 billionaires in the world today either never went to university or dropped out. Mm. There is very little relationship between academic outcomes, such as getting an MBA, and being successful in business. Now, it works for some people, but I've spoken to hundreds of MBAs over the years. Less than 10% of people would say to me, oh, well, if I didn't have this MBA, I wouldn't have been successful in business.
See, that's a common misconception. People think an MBA is going to help them run their business. MBAs are good for certain applications. They're okay for corporates. Okay for, you know, large multinational companies. They're pretty good to, on the one hand, not just, you know, as a qualification on a CV, but as far as content is concerned, there's certainly value in them. Just not when it comes to small to medium business, or not as much when it comes to small to medium business. And that's the common thing that people don't quite capture, I don't think, or they don't realize. And of the other, even doing a commerce or a business degree, again, it's got some really good concepts that one needs to understand if they're in business, but it does not. There's so much that is not covered when it comes to a commerce or a business degree.
That's right. And you have to weigh this up. If you've got a business, like my business was going crazy, I look back now and I say to myself, okay, well, the letters after my name and being an engineer, yeah, that's nice. But on balance, I paid too big a price. I probably should have, you know, bailed at the time when the writing was on the wall, both with Cockatoo Island. I should have bailed from that place. As soon as I got my 3 years up, I should have bailed. And I should have bailed from the university. And that business probably wouldn't have gone to 1 million in 5 or 6 years. It would have gone to 2 million in 5 or 6 years. And I probably could have sold it for 4 or 5 times as much as I sold it for. Mm. And I could have been and would have been better off doing some kind of bespoke training and having a mentor in a specific area that would have helped me resolve the sort of challenges that I was facing. Mm. When I did finance, financial accounting one, I think it was at the time, that was such an eye-opener to learn about profit and loss and balance sheets and so forth. But it never taught me about cash flow forecasting. It never taught me about the principles of working on 30-day terms and all these sorts of things. All that stuff I had to figure out for myself. And, you know, geez, and you'll hear this in later episodes, you know, hopefully you'll stick around for those because they get a bit more interesting. But the price that I paid for the lack of knowledge in being able to implement what is so obvious today to us having been down the track and, you know, having been broke. I mean, even here, this business was making so much money, but I was broke.
As in turnover, but not necessarily profit? Or you mean, yes, profit, but cash flow was poor?
Well, there was some profit there, but the cash flow was terrible. But, it, you know, like most people that are in business, they have, you know, such, usually the revenue is not too bad, and their accountant says, geez, you're doing something really well. What's happening? You know, you must be doing something right. And then the business owner is really puzzled by that, and they say to the accountant, something must be wrong because I can't pay my bills. I can't live week to week. And that's what was happening to me. So I was only keeping, at that point, I was only keeping about 5 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Well, that's not a great profit.
No, that's hopeless. That's really hopeless. You don't work 100 hours a week to make 5 cents on the dollar when, you know, you wind it back, you might be making $1 million, but that's only $50,000, right? I could have gone and made a lot more money working for somebody else. Okay. So, you know, I think the key takeaways from what I just talked about Tyler's introduction to the infamous Cockatoo Island. It's not so much about the island itself now, per se, which is now a tourist, very famous tourist destination, and where they hold all the ninja warriors in Australia. But it is the principle of deciding about what your work ethic is going to be, how you want to work and progress. It's a choice. And, you know, often we make the right choices and sometimes we make the wrong choices. On my reflection, I made some wrong choices and I made some right choices. And you know, if you look at my first job, which lasted 2 days and my salary doubled, clearly the hat that I wore whilst I worked there, I mean, what would have happened if I didn't have that allergy problem? My wage would have doubled. I probably would have been the highest paid worker there. I was 18. And within a very short space of time, I might have been moved up to leading hand, supervisor, and I might have ended up being the manager. I could have become the CEO of that organization at what might have been 19 or 20. And that's what happened at the next company I worked for, where that clearly within a year I would have been probably the CEO at 19.
So you got to, you know, the end of your time with Cockatoo, you left, you're focused on your business. What happened then? So it must have started growing much faster then.
It did. It did. And, you know, at that point, 18 months, within a year after the period that I left, it got to the point where I could no longer sustain running it from home. And when I say home, it's not like a two-bedroom apartment. Mm. This was a six-bedroom, two-lounge-room, two-bathroom,
a big
ginormous mansion with a container load full of assets in the driveway with parking for three cars, absolutely chock-a-block. I then moved into commercial premises and opened the first retail shop of its kind. Mm. I pivoted again.
So that's in lighting and audio
products. Yes, and I pivoted into party equipment, into a retail shopfront, which was the first of its kind. I had the school running, I had a rental department running, I had a sales department running, we had a manufacturing department running, in the sense that we had our own brand, right. And my father was looking after that primarily. I would design all these products. We would manufacture these with our own brand on it, so
products like what?
Well, speakers, consoles, sleeves, amplifier sleeves, you know, protective equipment. We partnered with other manufacturers and such things as electronic equipment with amplifiers, lighting controllers, all sorts of things, you know, manufacturing cables and leads. And then we partnered with a factory in Melbourne. We developed our own OEM brand, which will be another subject for another day. And we developed our own specialized features on the products, which provided enormous benefits that competitors and our counterparts didn't. One thing led to another. But our core niche of that business at all times, which we never lost sight of, was the income generated through the entertainment service offering, which is how we started, which goes back to the school.
And so what years were those?
Was 86 to 89, 90. And 89, at the end of 89, we had in Australia the recession, according to the Prime Minister at the time, or the Treasurer then at that point, the recession that we had to have.
Right.
And in 89, 90, we had a perfect storm. I opened a record shop as part of the complex because they took over the building next door as well. Mm-hmm. And just as I opened the record shop, CDs came out. Just as I took open the second store, they stopped, the local council stopped the parking in the front. So I had no parking on the main road because I had prime exposure, but you could no longer park anywhere near where we were. Yeah. We had our main operational manager depart. Right. Interest rates were in excess of 18%.
Oh my goodness. This is the official interest, like the bank interest.
Yes.
Not the credit card lending even.
You were flat out getting money under 20 points back then. Wonderful. I had a mortgage on a house which I just bought, and the interest rate just went straight through the roof. And it was and then the revenue, because we were in a discretionary market. It's not like bread and milk. People didn't have to have entertainment. They could skimp on that. Mm. When I pivoted again, now I'm going broke.
Mm. There's all these factors, the change in the parking, the change in the CDs versus records, the change in the economy.
Yeah. So I've invested all this capital into setting up, you know, buying stock for a record store, shop fitting it. The record store overnight was a failure. You know, with something like a music shop, you've got to have good access.
As in good parking?
And normally it's not a destination store. A record store would normally be in a mall.
Yeah.
You know, and we were on a major arterial road, which has now got a clear way, essentially, and in where we were, no parking. So, you know, the cars are just shooting right past the front of us, and that was doomed. And then the recession with the interest rates, turnover dropped down to the point where it was losing and venting significant money. And as I said, at that point, we were keeping 5 cents on the dollar. You know, and you contrast that level of stress. You know, my 2IC left. I had significant disruption with the staff. Now I'm having trouble paying the wages, trouble paying the rent. So I ended up breaking the lease. I also got wind that they were going to, which affected the parking at the back of the building, would you believe, develop and build units above the top of the shops. And even here, 30 years later, the same shops still exist, but it's like a ghost town. But the apartments above, they're all been sold, and everyone, you know, happy days there. You know, you contrast that stress with the stress I was going through when I was a Cockatoo Dockyard. Like, when I was working in the office and had all these four different things going on at that time, just like I did, I had all these different things going on when I opened up the complex. I was looking for every excuse to go down to the bathroom. I would go down to the bathroom and I'd fall asleep on the can, you know, with my head leaning up against the wall. I was that exhausted. I remember, you know, everything was run by bells back then. The bell would go at 12 and 12:30. That was your lunch break. I'd set my alarm to be on the phone from 12 to 12:25, and I gave myself exactly 5 minutes to eat my lunch. This is not the sort of stuff you want to try at home. Or if it was that bad, I would sleep between 12 and 12:25 if I couldn't possibly stay awake. You know, because sometimes I would DJ and I'd be out there till 2 a.m. and I'd have to get up at 6 the next morning to get to work and start at 7 o'clock.
So stress was mounting in your business. You had been all these changes in circumstances around it. You've decided to leave the premises, breaking the lease.
Yes.
And what, go back to work from home?
I then went to work from the home where I had the mortgage and I separated the home into two sections so that I had a section and I rented out the rest.
Okay.
And then I focused on my core niche, which is what we were best at from the beginning.
Which
was the supply of entertainment.
Right. And DJs, MCs and the
like. Yeah, for the five-star hotel market. And we pivoted again a year later and we were the first to go to market with full color, actually two color, very high quality literature and marketing material and brochures.
And how was your profitability in that?
Well, we went from 5 cents in the dollar to retaining 30 cents in the dollar. And not only that, but our conversion rate in the casual market more than doubled.
So you went from a retail, rental, were you importing as well, or was it just...
No, not at that point, but we were reselling and retailing.
Right.
But we bought products from other importers, but there weren't many of them, and getting good product and access to supply product was very hard to come
manufacturing,
by.
Manufacturing, record shop, all these, like, you know, what is it, 5-6 different businesses essentially, all the way back to your focus niche. And obviously at the same time, you were still doing the DJs, entertainers, MCs and all of that.
All the way
as
through.
As well. Okay. So that was stress city, I can only imagine.
Correct. Because we maxed out.
Yeah.
At 146, 150 bookings in 1 week. On one night, we could have 50 entertainers out there in the field. That's 50 contractors in any one night. Can you imagine the logistics? That's 50 cars, 50 pieces of equipment, and it's all electronics and hardware, software. You know, it was all back in the days of stylus needles, you know. So many moving parts and things could go wrong, where someone just didn't turn up on time. Yeah, so we went from 5 cents on a dollar to 30 cents on a dollar. Things became very relaxed very quickly. We implemented a new significant change in policy for the casual market. And that was that if you wanted to book us, you had to pay 50% down payment in advance to secure the booking. That was a major change. Because now we're getting paid in advance. Because if let's say that a gig was worth $200, we got $100 up front, that gig may be 2 or 3 months away. So now we're cash flow positive from the beginning.
Right.
So we fixed the cash flow.
An immediate cash flow.
We fixed the cash flow. We were more rigid in terms of the way in which we wouldn't pay the contractors unless we got paid first. And our overheads went down to next to nothing.
Because you're now working from home as opposed to commercial practices.
Correct.
And the actual value of your profit, did that change a great deal or was it just less stress?
No, the actual dollar value, net profit, went through the roof.
Right.
Turnover went down. We built the turnover back up again to about 60% of what it was, about half of what it was previously before the crash. And within 12 months of that complete turnaround, we went from a business that was absolute stress city, 100-hour weeks, to a business that could be run in under 40 hours a week and under management, and even to the point where I could switch the phones off or divert the phones. This was when mobile phones were now becoming popular. I could divert the phone.
The big one and the
no, the big ones were the 80s. That would, you know, like filled up the whole boot of the car. Actually, then I had the big brick, which was with a shoulder strap. Then to the handheld one, which was what everyone thinks is the brick, the one that was in the James Bond movie with Roger Moore, which is how far I go back. And they thought that was way ahead of its time. That quickly went out of date. But I'm talking about even like a, you know, 91 was the skinnier version of the original brick, which just sort of was able to fit in a leather pouch that, you know, would hang on your belt, but it wouldn't make your whole belt buckle fall off. But, you know, I could divert it to the phone.
Yep.
And my father and me, it could be a two-person business even, we were able to then go and play golf during the middle of the day.
Hmm.
We could do what we wanted hmm. when we wanted.
Sure. That's a bit more like it, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people get hung up a lot on turnover. You know, it's $1 million, it's $200 million. It's numbers with lots of zeros. When in fact, what really matters is the net. And what also really matters at the end of the day is the lifestyle, because that's what we're in business for. So we can have, a $500 million business and be making nothing at the bottom. And that would be the complete opposite of what we all wanted to achieve when we got into business in the first place. So we come back to the focus. We focus on those things that made the money. We focus on those things that we got into business for in the first place, as opposed to focusing on vanity type of metrics. And I know we talk a lot about the turnover figures that we've done, and it's they're big and they're impressive.
Supposedly, we're not compared to Warren Buffett,
of course.
Yeah.
Compared to the standard small business. But the reason we quote those numbers is to show that we have been around and we've done our days and we've done our dues. So the things that we're coming back to again and again, or the lessons that we come back to again and again, is keeping your eye on the prize, what really matters, what are we here for, why are we doing what we're doing, and not lose track, and also focus, because we need to focus on those things. You know, they say the 80-20 rule, Pareto rule, rules and so on, is, you're making 80% of your profit from the thing that you're actually doing 20% of the work in. So let's just focus on those things and keep cutting away those pieces of the pie that are causing us stress, causing us work, and not giving us enough benefit. Really try and focus and keep on reviewing over and over.
It seems obvious on reflection, but when you're there in the zone, and quite often entrepreneurs, they end up making the same mistake repeatedly in future businesses, and certainly I've done that as well, and we'll talk about that in future episodes, where the stakes were significantly higher.
Mm.
We're talking now in hundreds of thousands or the low millions, as opposed to the hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
And the tens of millions, where, the bigger you get, the harder you fall. I was able to turn all of this around within less than 12 months, again, with no acquisitions, no mergers, no funding, no VCs, no angels, no nothing, just by perseverance and grit and being creative and going back to the core element of my business, which relied upon those strategic alliance partners that I had developed early on in the design of the business structure from the beginning,
And within, 2 or 3 years after that, you sold that business at unheard of sort of figures, but we'll have to cover that in a different episode. But, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to build an asset so that it's saleable,
correct,
so that it's delegatable, so it can run without you, and you can then capitalize and move on.
And that was not evident in the mandate during all that madness from Cockatoo right up until the recession. None of the thoughts were in my head about building an asset which one day I could sell, whereas that was what was partly motivating me now. And of course, as you'll hear from the profits we were making at keeping 30 cents on the dollar, I have an expression that any business that keeps 30 cents on the dollar is a damn good business. And with those profits, which was cash in the bank profits, not just, you can have net profit on paper, but not have cash. We had cash, and we were able to then start other businesses, which then went on to become businesses that turned over tens and tens of millions of dollars, which we can talk about later. Some of which became, one in particular, became a household brand. And it all came from that original niche in the first instance.
Mm.
So I think, as you said, keeping your eye on the prize and not being caught up in vanity metrics such as revenue, and understanding such things that I didn't understand when I first started business, even though I did finances down the track, It still wasn't clear to me until basically the 90s. So I'd been going through all this up and down and back and forth and sleeping on the floor, you know, scaling like mad, still chasing the casual market despite the fact that we focused, you know, or we had that other part of the market all to ourselves. We should have just focused on that.
And the other thing, Rick, that also comes to mind is that a lot of the time, unfortunately, and, you know, we all like to think otherwise, but a lot of the time we as entrepreneurs think, make decisions emotionally. It doesn't seem like it's emotional at the time. We feel like something will work, it needs to work, you just need this and this and this put into place and it will work. But really, it's an emotional motivation. Quite often, it's the fear of having failed, when in fact, we all really need to take a completely different view of the word failure. And again, that's another story for another time. But you were quickly able to get rid of that emotional stigma of I failed, yada yada, oh no, I'm going to try harder, I'm going to keep trying harder. You just slashed it out of the equation. If it wasn't working, it was just not right for now.
Well,
and you had to just go zero in on what works, and that's what got you out of it.
My attitude was in the second half of 1990 when I was rebuilding. Mm. 1991 was when I really pulled it together, was all the lessons that I learned in the 80s I was going to put into practice in the 90s in this business. And I wasn't going to make the same mistake again. I ended up making similar mistakes years later. That's another story. But as far as that business is concerned, we were right on the money from 91, 92 onwards, and turned around it and sold it for a huge profit. So, yeah, I think, you know, if you put the original, how I opened up this particular episode in terms of, you know, Edward de Bono's principle of what hat you're going to wear, what your modus operandi is going to be, what your work ethic is going to be, what you put in is what you get out, garbage in, garbage out, like I said in episode one. When you put it all together and you think about what's happening and study what's happening at the time, in situ there and then, and take a step back, you know, like the fly on the wall, look down. If you know enough, which sadly most people in business, when they go into business, they don't, especially in the beginning. And they get a degree quite often and they think that they're going to know enough because they got a degree, they know a lot about business, but in fact they don't. It then gives you the capacity to be able to pivot sensibly, not only as an entrepreneur, but an intrapreneur, as in a person who can be successful and move their way up into a business to the point where they may end up being a shareholder, or to the point where they may have to move on and develop their side hustle into something which is a full-time gig, which is what I ended up doing, and not flicking the switch too early to make that pivot decision. So I think that's a sort of a summarizing our points that I wanted to say for this episode.
Okay. And well, I mean, that concludes episode number two, and next up, we'll see what happens next.
See you then.
Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. Help us spread the joys of entrepreneurship by liking, sharing, and reviewing this series.